Case number 21-7034, Leonard A. Saxon Associates, B.C., Appellant versus International Monetary Fund. Mr. Spence for the appellant, Mr. Newland for the appellant.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question. Counsel, have you been tested so you don't have to argue with the mask on?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I have we're visiting the family this weekend, and I have a daughter with severe autoimmune disease.
Thank you. Well, try to speak loud. We'd like to have a help.
I realize it's hard without being able to see that somebody's mouth moving.
Exactly.
I will do my best. May I please report, though? My name is Donald Spence. I represent the appellate Leonard A. Saxon Associates, D.C. This is a case about a contract between a lawyer and his client, the IMF. On this contract, the IMF waived his immunity. Disputes with this court. It agreed to arbitration to dissolve those disputes and incorporated the American Arbitration Association rules in the District of Columbia law. The only question here is, looking at the plain language of the contract, whether the dispute resolution clause includes judicial review of the arbitration award. This is a straightforward question of contract interpretation. A fact position is that the IMF, as it is permitted to do under its articles and agreements, expressly waived immunity for purposes of dissolving dispute by incorporating the DC law and rules. Both provide judicial review of the award. The IMF makes three arguments as to why there is no judicial review. First, the IMF agrees that DC law applies to it, but it claims that the right to judicial review under the DC code is certainly a part of DC law. The Uniform Arbitration Act is not. Contract doesn't say that. It doesn't provide any limitations with regard to the applicability of DC law. It simply says in the first part, quote, the arbitrable case shall be decided according to the law of the District of Columbia. Secondly, IMF argues that while it agreed that AAA rules apply, and in fact the parties did go to arbitration here, it claims that AAA Rule 52C does not. Rule 52C, in fact, provides that an award can be confirmed by a court, a civil, state, or federal court, and the jurisdiction. There's nothing in this contract that excludes this rule or any other rule. Our brief cited the case of California Parking Service, where the contract that drafted specifically excluded the applicable AAA rule relating to judicial review. Contract in this case is.
Well, why doesn't it, Mr. Spence, because it has a reservation of immunity, even in the arbitration clause. So why isn't that, in effect, saying we will arbitrate, but without any assistance, confirmation, enforcement, compulsion, or subpoena assistance from a court?
And that's my next argument. And here's why. If you look at the specific language of the arbitration clause, you start at the top of section 20.1, and it's an observation with regard to the IMF's existence and immunity. It talks about the statutory basis of the IMF, and that the IMF has immunity from the judicial process. But what it doesn't do, this is an introductory paragraph, what it doesn't do is specifically state that the IMF is not waiving immunity under this particular contract. It's an observation or a declaration, not a direct promise. And if you look at
the end of the clause, doesn't it specifically make a point that Judge Bullock just made?
It does not. I'll tell you why. The end of the last sentence is understood and agreed that the submission of a claim or dispute shall not excuse and shall be considered waived. The act of.
I know how your voice just trails us off.
I apologize, sir.
I mean, it trails off to you.
I will keep it up. The act of submission or dispute, the act of submitting the claim itself is not a waiver. And that makes sense, Judge, because if I submit a claim, that's not the essence, that's not the essence of what I'm looking for. I'm going to get to a word. There's where the waiver is. But what they've done is they've taken this very narrow act, submission of a claim, and said, that doesn't waive your immunity. That makes sense. It's an internal conflict.
What could it be referring to, if not immediately related to the arbitration that this subclause contemplates?
It's not addressing the award. It's not addressing the confirmation. It's not addressing the arbitration, the hearings.
My question is why not? It says, submission of a claim or dispute to arbitration shall not be considered to be a waiver of the immunities of the IMF. So if it isn't saying submission to arbitration continues to exclude any of all court involvement, what is it there?
What it's saying is when I submit my claim, I'm saying only F. That's not a waiver of the immunity. It stops there. They're talking about is what I submit. That them saying, just because you say it doesn't mean so.
So it's guarding against counterclaims. You need to be more specific. I'm not sure what you're talking about.
It's saying that regardless of what I submit, that until I go through the process, there's no order.
Who's a client?
Me being the claim of me being the backers. So I have a claim I submitted. That's my submission. There's no waiver. Then we go through the arbitration process. Then an award is given. Therefore, the waiver is. Because there we've adopted the AAA rules. You have to proceed in accordance with those rules and an award is an issue.
Counsel, so I'm not sure I agree with your interpretation. But unless this moment was ambiguous, what happens under the arbitral law?
If it's ambiguous, the IMF is drafted this time.
I'm sorry?
Ambiguity goes against the draft.
Well, no, wait a minute. What's the general law here? Doesn't it have to be an explicit waiver of immunity?
The explicit waiver of immunity is above the clause to look.
No. This is generally asking an explicit waiver.
I agree.
So if there was ambiguity, which I don't think is, but if there was ambiguity, you lose.
I don't agree. I think there's enough of the ambiguous sentence is actually the sentence that starts accordingly and notwithstanding anything.
I'm talking about it in the whole interpretation. The best you could make it would be ambiguous. And if it's ambiguous, you lose, right? It is correct, isn't it?
It is correct that if I cannot show that there's been an express waiver, I lose.
Well, that's what's so. If it's ambiguous, you would lose.
I don't think that it goes to the waiver itself. I think it goes to the procedures with regard to the process.
No, no.
Well, it's clear from the contract that we go to arbitration. It's clear from the contract DC law applies. The idea, it's clear that if the arbitral case is governed by DC law or decided by DC law.
What does DC law get you in terms of this question about arbitration enforceability? In terms of the arbitration process, isn't DC law granted by the Federal Arbitration Act? DC law is just something that's subsequent to contract, no?
It means whether you talk about the Federal Arbitration Act or the DC law, the result's going to be the same. So those acts would have the same impact on those states.
I thought you were relying on DC law to support your enforceability.
I am because I believe that the contract says I have to rely on DC law. And so that's why I'm doing it. What DC law does for me is it provides a review of the process. If you look at the process of confirmation, modification, or vacation of the award, those modifications or vacating an award goes to is was the process fair? Was the was there evident partiality or was there some refusal to consider the fair election or alleged here? And so that's what DC law does. And when what you look at here, right, is the arbitral law will be decided according to the terms of the contract of the law of the District of Columbia. You can't just say, okay, well, some law applies over here, but I'm going to ignore the DC law with regard to the statute over there. That doesn't make sense. You've got to read this thing as a whole. That's what DC law requires. The all terms of the contract be given lawful effect, reasonable law of effect meaning. The if you stick with the IMS interpretation, what you're doing is you're reading out the 52 law.
Reading out what?
You're reading out Rule 52 of the American Arbitration. You're reading out DC, pieces of DC law by saying that, DC Informed Arbitration Act doesn't apply. And you turn the last sentence in this section into service because there's no reason for it to, there's no reason if you have blanket immunity, then why are you putting a clause in here? It's protecting yourself during the submission of the claim. And that's the thing that doesn't make sense. You've got to read this stuff. I mentioned the California Department of Services case earlier. There, the draft of the contract specifically excluded certain purposes, the AAA rule we wanted to do the review. The IMF drafted this contract. If they had that sentence, it would be clear to my client, clear indication to my client up front that the ramifications of an unenforceable, of the ramifications of an unenforceable arbitration rule, SAC didn't get that chance. That language is in India. The language in here, the reasonable interpretation is that DC law applies, that AAA rules apply, and that's the proper interpretation.
Thank you. Good morning, may I please report James Newman for the International Monetary Fund. Before the court, we ask the court to affirm the district court order because the plaintiff has not established that the fund has expressly waived its absolute judicial immunity as required by not only its part of this agreement.
I take it to the finding that after the arbitration had voted against you, you could say, go pound sand. We're not going to do it.
But they haven't.
You know what, counsel? You give them a hypothetical, the worst answer you can possibly give them, that's not this. So, why don't you deal with mine?
Yeah, in theory, Your Honor, they're absolutely immune from every form of judicial process.
The answer to my question is you can say, what pounds?
They couldn't be held in court to enforce the award for sure, which I think is the answer to your question. They could say, go pound sand, but they haven't. And then even if we get into these types of policy discussions, whether that's fair or unfair, all of those policy considerations were decided in 1945 in Bretton Woods, Hampshire, right? But the fund negotiated for absolute immunity. All of the member countries at that time agreed, policy reasons, that the fund's absolute immunity from every form of judicial process is critical to its role in the international process. So we don't get into these policy determinations, but the fund is the general and stuff negotiated for absolute immunity and absolute things.
Mr. Newland, how do you square your position with the Supreme Court's decision in Female Enterprises, where the court said the arbitration team has to have a real-world objective. It's not designed for the recognition of the game lacking practical consequences. And basically saying arbitration without a waiver of immunity to the extent of reducing it to a judgment is just not arbitration at all.
I think two things, Judge Miller. First, CNM Enterprises is clearly distinguishable because in that case, the contract itself, right? Not for arbitration or anything else. The contract itself said you could reduce this award in any court without to the court having conflict jurisdiction.
That's true, but interestingly, the court really doesn't focus on that. But you're right, that is a distinction.
Yeah, but so if they found a tribal waiver, and then they go to this point about policy determination about what if it's an arbitration without a world war. And they say that, I think right at the end of the report, they also had that the contract out from the here again, like any policy we have so many, any policy determinations about whether that's fair or not were decided then not for this court to revisit, I suggest. I mean, here, the claim test and JAM in particular is that there must be an express waiver that the IMF negotiated for absolute immunity.
Nobody questions that the default is waiver and that there, I mean, that the default is immunity and that it cannot be initiated in the absence of an express waiver. Really, the question here is there is an express clause providing for arbitration. What are the implications of that? And I take your position to be that the arbitration in this contract is basically a potential aid to voluntary settlement and nothing, that there is no ability of any counterparty to the IMF to compel arbitration under this law, to seek witness, seek a court assistance, witness under this law, or to confirm or enforce an award rendered by the AAA under this law. That's your position.
I think that's certainly consistent.
Absolutely. Is that your position?
It is.
So binding arbitration, in what sense is the reference in the contract to binding arbitration binding? They can't be enforced in the court. They can be fully ignored.
No, I think the point there is exactly reinforces our point, and that is the arbitration itself is final and binding. Those are words, by the way, that are in the standard arbitration clause. They were added to reinforce the point that the arbitration is the end.
Final, but it's binding in what sense? It's no binding, this is with
the bar. No, it's binding on the parties. The arbitration result is binding on the parties. In this case, that's exactly what the fund did. They had an arbitration, they went through it. They didn't say we're not going to arbitration in the other cases. Here, the fund went to arbitration, it received an award that was adverse to it, and it tendered payment to Mr. Sachs. That's the end of it. It's final and binding. There isn't a mechanism. When you have absolute immunity, absent your own express waiver, there's no mechanism to revisit whether that's a good policy or not. And I think what the plaintiffs attempt to do, or what Mr. Sachs attempts to do, is argue for a policy exception and that the court should make a policy determination and use that to overturn the clear language of a treaty enshrined in a federal statute and reinforce the contract.
I don't read into you making any of those arguments. I read into the argument about what it means to agree to the contract.
It means exactly what the contract says, an arbitration at the end, that notwithstanding the submission of arbitration, there's no waiver of the fund's immunity to the judicial process. That's crystal clear. And by the way, it also says in the opening, these are our immunities. They're incorporated into the federal law and DC law. And accordingly, this is what we're agreeing to. We're agreeing that we're submitting to arbitration, that the arbitrators themselves will apply DC law in the case. Nothing more, nothing less. There's nothing here. I think Sachs urges that there's a contract choice of law clause. There isn't. If you look at CNL, there is a contract choice of law clause. The contract itself says, but the contract will be governed by the place of the project, the path which is enacted.
Is the contract an issue here, a standard contract? The IMF, you with other vendors or
see, it's the one I saw. Same contract. It is. Yeah. I'm not saying it's the only one they have. It's a huge organization in the world. But it is a standard contract for professional services.
You say in one sentence of your brief that the IMF's executive board would have to waive the IMF's immunity. But I didn't see anything other than the affidavit that supported them. In fact, the bylaws and the Articles of Agreement that are referred to don't have any reference to this process. Can you help me
understand
where that is supported?
Absolutely. If you go back to the Articles of Agreement, and I believe it's actually in Article 12, Section 2, all powers that aren't directly granted to one of the organs get granted to the Board of Governors. Either internally, the Board of Governors has granted that to the Executive Board in 3A of the Articles.
What?
Requiring that any waiver of the fund's judicial immunity is done through the executive board.
So, if the arbitrator corrupt and were bribed to reach the holding. That's something that potentially an attorney general could go after, but not the county.
Okay. Fair. And in this court's case,
sorry, I didn't hear.
And we have all the.
I didn't hear Judge Pillar's
question. Judge Pillar's question was if there was some kind of misconduct on the part of the arbitrator, fraud, bribery, that type of thing, that the counterparty couldn't go after, couldn't come to court and vacate the arbitration award. Perhaps DOJ was the one to go after the arbitrator. I confirm that. But then the last point I'm making is a time is they do talk about Rosebud here, and Rosebud I think is not on the first. Rosebud doesn't have any of the express preservation immunities language that we find not once but twice in our conversation. Rosebud also talks about an express waiver standard that I don't think is consistent with this court's view of what it takes for a foreign sovereign, which again has a lower level of immunity, which has absolute immunity, what the standard is for an express waiver. And here, what they've asked you to do is look at this clause and do what you shouldn't do under the Gamble, and that is look for clauses of parts that are in tension with each other or suggestive of waiver. We don't have any of that. There's no explicit express waiver anywhere in this contract. And in fact, the clause itself preserves the immunities. And with that, we ask the court to confirm the district court.
No time.
Now.
Thank you, Ron. Just 2 points. One is, if you look at 3.1, you have to look really hard to see that that's an express protection. You're right. I think there's 24 seconds in that. An express assertion of the immunity. It's not. It's an introductory clause. It says, hey, we have a meeting. We're breaching the statute and we have a meeting. That's all it says. And then we'll go to the accordingly, notwithstanding anything that the contrary was agreement. It is expressly agreed and understood. And there follows the rule. There follows the rippling rules. There follows the law of different. We wrote Rosebud. There's Rosebud does, and it applies in this case because it shows that the court and that this court can consider modification of vacating under these identical circumstances. Finally, CM Enterprises, that case applies. The distinction about the body of the contract.
Yeah, but they found that that's the court case. Then that forms a specific reference to the person.
That identical reference is in part is in Rule 52 of the Privilege Rule. It's the same.
That's all I think. All the next page.